Underworld, Disc 23.
She sat there, Rosemary Shea, doing her beadwork. She had the frame set on two small sawhorses. She had the four bolts screwed in that held the frame together, those bolts with wing nuts at one end. She had the material pinned to the edges of the frame. She had the wood-handled needle that she used to string the beads onto the material, following the printed design, greenish beads arrayed in a flossy thread. She heard Nick doing something at the kitchen table. She said, "You should go get the meat." She did her beadwork and listened to him doing whatever he was doing, writing something, it sounded like, but not for school, she didn't think. She said, "It's paid for, and they close soon, so you should think about going." She did her beadwork, her piecework, sweaters, dresses, and blouses. She did whole trousseaus sometimes, working off the books, just as Jimmy had. She did her work and listened to Nick finally go out the door. Then she went and looked at the piece of paper he'd left on the table. Made no sense to her at all. Arrows, scrawls, numbers, circled numbers, a phone number in the Marion Exchange. Letters with numbers next to them. Some simple additions and divisions, all scribbled frantically on the page. She listened to the radio and did her work. She made an official salary, the money she reported answering the phone for a local lawyer and typing wills and deeds and leases, mostly, and immigration forms, and listening to the lawyer's funny stories. He told all the new jokes and had a backlog of 1,000 old ones, and he liked to sing the Dark Town Strutter's Ball in Italian, a thing he did more or less automatically, like breathing or chewing gum. The job was good for her because it put her in contact with other people, and because it had the virtue of fairly flexible hours. And the money, of course, was life and death. Bronzini walked toward Tremont, past apartment buildings with front stoops and fire escapes, past a number of private homes, some with a rose bush or a shade tree, little frame houses beginning to show another kind of growth, spindly, winged antennas. He was wondering about being it. This was one of those questions that he tortured himself deliciously with. Another player tags you, and you're it. What exactly does this mean, beyond being neutered? You are nameless and bedeviled. It. The evil one whose name is too potent to be spoken. Or is the term just a Cockney pronunciation of hit? When you tag someone, you hit her. You're it, missy. Cockney or Scots or something. A woman rapped a penny on the window, calling her child into dinner. A fearsome power in the term, because it makes you separate from the others. You flee the tag, the telling touch, but once you're it, name-shorn, neither boy nor girl, you're the one who must be feared. You're the dark power in the street, and you feel a kind of demonry, chasing the players, trying to put your skelly-bone hand on them, to spread your taint, your curse. Speak the syllables slowly, if you can. A whisper of death, perhaps. Half a block from his building, on a street where the Italians thinned out and the Jews began to appear, and approaching now to see his mother in the first-floor window, cranked up in her special bed, white hair shining in the soft light. Baseball's oh so simple. You tag a man, he's out. How different from being it. What spectral genius in the term, that curious part of childhood that sees through the rhymes and nonsense words, past the hidings and seekings and pretendings, to something old and dank, some medieval awe, he thought, or earlier even, that crawls beneath the midnight skin. The young man struck the match with one hand. He'd learned this when he first started smoking about a year ago, although it seemed to him that he'd been smoking forever, old golds, isolating the match by closing the cover behind it and then bending the match back against the striking surface below and driving the head with his thumb. Then he brought the flared match up to his cigarette, his hand cupping the whole book with the match still secured. He lit up, shook out the flame, and conceded use of the other hand to pluck the spent match from the book and send it to match hell. You need these useless skills to make an impression on the street. The science teacher fading into the evening, southbound, and his former student, Shay, a mopey C-plus in introductory chemistry, walking the other way on the same street into the shopping district, taking deep drags on his cigarette with numbers running in his head. Ever since the game yesterday, Nick's been seeing the number 13. The game, the mass hurrah, the way he crouched over his radio, ready to puke his guts all over the roof. All day today, 13s coming out of the woodwork. He had to get a pencil to list them all. Branca wears number 13. Branca won 13 games this year. The Giants started their pennant drive 13.5 games behind the Dodgers. The month and day of yesterday's game, 10-3. Add the digits, you get 13. The Giants won 98 games this year and lost 59, including the playoffs. 9-8-5-9. Add the digits, reverse the result, see what you get, shitface? The time of the home run, 3:58. Add the digits of the minutes, 13. The phone number people call for inning-by-inning scores, ME-71212. M is the 13th letter of the alphabet. Add the 5 digits, old 13. Take the name Branca. This is where he started going crazy. Take the name Branca and assign a number to each letter based on its position in the alphabet. This is where he started thinking he was crazy as his brother, doing chess positions or probabilities or whatever the kid does. Take the name Branca. The B is 2, the R is 18, and so on and so on. You end up with 39. What is 39? It is the number which, when you divide it by the day of the month of the game, gives you 13. Thompson wears number 23. Subtract the month of the year, you know what you get? Two guys were pushing a car to get it started. Nick nearly went over to help, but then didn't. He was done with baseball now, he thought. The last thin thread connecting him to another life. He saw the old man who dressed as a priest, more or less, wearing a cassock sometimes with house slippers, or one of those ridged black hats a priest wears blessing the fucking multitudes, and ordinary shabby street clothes. He walked into the butcher shop. The bell over the door rattled, and the butcher stood above the block, Cousin Joe, hacking at a pork loin. The other butcher said, "Hey, look who's here." He said it in the way you say something in passing, to no one in particular. Cousin Joe looked up. "Look who's here," he said. "Nicky, what's the word?" The other butcher said, "Hey, he wants to be called Nick. You don't know this?" "Hey, I know this guy since he's 4 years old. A little skinny malink. How long you been coming in here, Nicky?" Nick smiled. He knew he was only a stationary object, a surface for their carom shots. "I seen him with that girl he goes with, Loretta," the second butcher said.
"You think he's getting some?"
"I know he is, because I look at his face when they walk by."
"Nicky, tell me about it. Make me feel good," the butcher said. "Because I'm reaching the point I have to hear other people's, you know, whatever it is they're doing that I'm not doing anymore."
"I think he's a cunt man, up and coming."
"Just true, Nicky?"
Nick's mood was improving.
"I think he's getting so much there's not enough left over for the rest of us," the second butcher said, Antoine, barely visible behind the display case.
"Make me feel good, Nicky. I stand here all day. I look at 'em go by. Big women, short women, girls from Roosevelt, girls from Aquinas. You know what I say to myself? Where's mine?"
"Nicky's got yours. He's got mine's, too."
"Him? I could believe it."
"And you know why, Joe?"
"He's doing something he shouldn't be doing."
"He's got that pussy smile when he walks by, which could only mean one thing. The kid is eating box lunch at the Y."
"Sboccato,"
the butcher said happily, berating Antone, rasping the word from deep in his throat. "Foul mouth. Nick went to the door and opened it, and waited for a woman to walk past, and then flicked his cigarette toward the curbstone.
"Who's better than him?"
Anton said. "You going to school, Nicky?"
"He goes when he goes. Hey, who's better than him?"
Anton said.
"I would give my right arm."
Anton took the bag out of the case. It held chops, chicken breasts, and fresh bacon. He passed it over the top to Nick.
"Who's better than you?"
he said.
"Be good,"
Cousin Joe said.
"My right arm I would give. Look at this kid."
A taste of blood and sawdust hung in the air.
"Regards to your mother, okay?"
"Be good, okay?"
"Be good," the butcher said.
Bronzini lay beaming in the massive bath, a cast-iron relic raised on ball and claw feet, only his head unsubmerged. Salt crystals fizzed all around him. His wife leaning against the doorframe, Clara, with their 2-year-old affixed to her leg, the child repeating words that Daddy issued from the deeps.
"Tangerine," Albert said. This was happiness, as it was meant to evolve when first conceived in caves, in mud huts on the grassy plain. Mamala and our beautiful Bambina.
And his own mother, ghastly ill, but here at last, murmurous, a strong and mortal presence in the house. And Albert himself, in the hot bath, back from the hunt, returned to the fundamental cluster. He summarized the meeting with Father Paulus. A slouching Clara seemed about to speak several times, the way her body begins to drag along a surface, going restless and skeptical.
"An impressive man. I want you to come along next time, or I'll invite him here."
"He doesn't want to come here."
"Doctorate in philosophy at Yale. Graduated magna cum laude in sacred theology from some Jesuit center in Europe. Louvain, I believe."
And he formed the word as a privileged utterance.
"Holds a chair in the humanities at Fordham. But he's not inclined to help you with the boy." "He'll help. He'll come to a match."
"Tangerine,"
he said to the child, and raised his arms out of the water. Clara lifted the girl up over the roll rim of the tub, and Albert sat up and took her under the arms, holding her upright, feet in white socks barely touching the water, so she could step along the surface, laughing, making little kick waves. And he felt like a mother seal. Yes, a mother. Not some raucous, coughing bull, or whatever the male is called. He would have to look it up.
"Do you know the old painting," he said, "that shows dozens of children playing games in some town square?"
"Hundreds, actually. 200, anyway. Bruegel. I find it unwholesome."
"Why?"
"It came up in conversation."
"I don't know what art history says about this painting, but I say it's not that different from the other famous Bruegel. Armies of death marching across the landscape. The children are fat, backward, a little sinister to me. It's some kind of menace, some folly, Kinderspielen. They look like dwarves doing something awful."
He held the girl kicking, raising her just above the surface, then dropping her a notch so she could splash lightly, laughing when the spray hit him in the face.
"Fat and backward. Did you hear that, little girl?
As a matter of fact, she's getting pretty heavy, isn't she?
Whoa! Aren't you, sweetheart?"
Sooner or later, the daily litany of delicate questions and curt replies.
"And my mother?"
"Resting."
"And the doctor came?"
"No."
"The doctor did not come?"
"No."
"When is he coming?"
"Tomorrow."
"Tomorrow. And Mrs. Ketchell looked in?"
"Looked in, exactly."
The child stepped along the surface, and he lifted her high so Clara could take her. She swung her past the end of the tub and managed to have her wet socks off about a second after she touched down. One of those thousand-a-day death struggles of mother and child. wails and bent limbs, and a certain physical insistence on the woman's part. All done in a compact blur that dazzled Albert and made him lean over the edge to espy the two dinky socks lying soggy on the tile as confirmation. His mother suffered from a neuromuscular condition, myasthenia gravis, and she lay helpless much of the time. Eyelids sagged, arms too weak to move except in ever slower syllables of gesture, reduced to units now, and her vision evidently doubled. He recited the word for the child one last time as she was hustled out. He'd brought his mother here, prevailing over her own fatalism and his wife's practical misgivings. You are the son, you take care of the parents. And the illness, the drama of a failing body, the way impending death made her seem saintly, with an icon's fixedness, a stern and staring and enameled beauty. Albert, who shunned any form of organized worship and thought God was a mass delusion, sat and watched her for hours, combed her hair, soaked up her diarrhea with bunched Kleenex, talked to her in his boyhood Italian, and he felt that the house, the flat, was suffused with a reverence, old, sad, heavy, and impressive, an otherworldliness, now that she was here. The salts had stopped fizzing, and he lay in silence a while. He felt the contentment begin to slip away. There was something about evening, perhaps, that caused a transient sadness. He heard Clara in the kitchen preparing the meal. Things there he must keep at a distance, her moods, her doubts. He thought about his own situation, things he must confront, his complacency, his distractedness, his position at school, his Sneaky Pete drinking. It came to him suddenly when it finally came. Tangerine. How he'd stood in the market this afternoon peeling the loose-skinned fruit and eating the sweet sections, slightly stinging as the juice washed through his mouth. And how the scent seemed to breathe some essence, but why, of Morocco. And now he knew, incontrovertibly, tangerine, Tanger, Tangier, the port from which the fruit was first shipped to Europe. He felt better now, thank you. How language is webbed in the senses. Out of sand-blaze brilliance into quirky minds such as his, into touch, taste, and fragrance. He thought he'd linger just a bit longer, let the bath take total hold, ease and alleviate, before he put on clothes and entered the complex boxes where people do their living. Nothing fits the body so well as water. Chapter 2 Later they would go get the car, but first they hung around a while, letting the night close in, sitting on the stoop in front of 611. Juju did not sit down until he spread his hanky on the steps. He was talking about the new model cars, just out. This one's got the horsepower, that one's got the handling, and he was earnest and fervent.
You talk like you're ready to whip out your wallet, Nick said, when you know and I know.
Scarfo stood on the corner about 10 yards away, eating a jelly apple, a grown man, holding it away from his body and leaning in to bite.
There's nothing in there but a rubber.
They watched people come home from work. Nick sat haunched on the iron rail just above Juju. It was cold, and they came plugging home, clerks, bus drivers, garment workers, elevator operators. Nick watched them and smoked.
That's you, he said. What are you talking? 2 years, tops, that's you, he said. Could happen sooner. It's a job. They have jobs. What do you want them to do? I'll tell you what I think. Save me a drag on that cigarette.
They watched Scarfo talking to the shoemaker, holding the jelly apple at arm's length now.
Anything's better than what they're doing. That's what I think.
They're working. Let them work. Nick watched and smoked. Secretaries, maintenance men, bank tellers, messengers, typists in the typing pool, stenographers in the steno pool.
It's not the work, it's the regular hours, Nick said.
Going in the same time every day, clocking in, taking the train. It's the train. Going in together, coming home together.
You're better than that.
I'm better, I'm worse. What's the difference?
When Nick took the last drag on the cigarette, he held the butt with his thumb and middle finger. The middle finger poised to flick so that he took the drag and flicked in one prolonged motion, sending the butt toward the curbstone.
Thanks, Juju said.
For what?
You'd rather collect 20 weeks a year than have a steady job that pays decent?
I tell you what I'd rather do. I'd rather get my dick sucked by the one in the green coat.
Where?
The one in the green coat.
Where?
Across the street, Nick said.
You like that?
Hey, I didn't say I want to marry her.
You couldn't save me a drag.
What? Did you ask?
She's awful short, Juju said.
Good. She can blow me standing up.
Save wear and tear on her knees.
God makes short people for a reason.
Scarfo wore neat, creased pants and good shoes, and he ate with his body contorted to keep the jelly from dripping on his clothes. He was talking to the shoemaker about something, and the shoemaker stood there squat-bodied and blank.
You got gas money?
Juju said.
We don't need gas. For where we're going?
Where are we going?
To the pool room, Nick said.
They watched the shoemaker think. Like watching a bulldog take a crap. The people came home from work, thinning out over time, the merest scatter now. It was the night before Thanksgiving, and there was a thing you were supposed to feel about a holiday and a day off and getting ready for the big feast with the relatives coming over. But Nicky's days off had started a couple of weeks earlier when he stopped going to school, and there weren't any relatives nearby, which was something, in fact, to be thankful for. He tapped Juju on the shoulder. They walked over to Quarry Road, a stretch of weedy landscape traveled mainly by dog walkers. This was where the 46 Chevy waited, at the base of the high stone wall that surrounded the hospital for the incurable. They were too young to have driver's licenses, but it didn't matter because the car was stolen anyway. They had seen it parked near the zoo about 3 weeks ago, key in the ignition, near nightfall. And Nick had gotten in, an impulse, a thing you don't even have time to dare yourself to do, and he started up the engine. Juju watched for a second and got in. Vito was with them, Bats, and he got in. They drove around for much of the night, and it was still a joke, an escapade. And they chipped in for gas and drove around some more, and then left the car parked next to an empty lot, with Nick taking the keys. And it was still there the next day. They got a set of plates from Vito's uncle's car that was in traction, more or less, for the winter, and they exchanged these for the original plates and drove mainly at night, because the brashness had given way to a responsible sense of ownership. And they went only limited distances because it seemed safer, and they didn't have money to spend on gas, and there was nowhere to go anyway. Juju started the car up, and they sat there listening to it throb.
You see what you're doing to this, Matt? Nick said. Only 3 weeks it's been. You're wearing it out. You're wearing down the ridges with your feet, you and her. Use the back seat, animal.
The back seat's cramped.
Animale.
It's roomier up here.
Juju and his girlfriend shared the front seat for hours at a time. Gloria, French kissing into the night, the young man's hands exploratory. But it was the action of their feet that caused the trouble. It was the grinding of their feet in unavailing passion that was destroying the traction on the mat.
Explain to her that if she puts out, Gloria, in a polite way, tell her the damage to the car will be reduced in the long run. You won't have all this frustration that the both of you take out on the furniture.
The furniture.
Put out or stay out. Tell her nice, nice, because we can't afford this girl destroying our property.
Juju put the car in gear and drove the two blocks to the pool room, parking away from the streetlight. They got out, examined the car, and then crossed the street and went up the long flight of steel-tipped stairs and through the tall metal door into the sparse smoke of the big room, where a single dim figure was hunched over a table, cue ball spinning in the gloom.
A woman rapped a penny on the window, and Clara looked up. The woman waved, "Mrs. Somebody," and Clara smiled and hurried on. She had company coming, and she was late. She stopped for some things at the grocer's, and then went up the front steps, and there was Albert's mother in the window, cranked up, wearing a white hospital gown and facing straight out, with a religious medal dangling, and she looked a little like a vision, or someone waiting for a vision. Clara didn't want to give this striking scene a title out of some Renaissance gallery, because that would be unkind. But the fact, after all, was that the woman was on display. Mrs. Ketchell sat with Albert's mother this afternoon. The child was being minded by a girl in the building who was capable and trustworthy. Clara tidied the place a little, not much, and then stood in the spare room looking at the sketch on the easel, a study of the room itself. She'd been sketching the room for some time now. She did studies of the door frame, the moldings on the walls. She did the luggage stacked in the corner. When Rochelle rang the bell, she was standing in the kitchen, smoking. "So, Clara, here you are." "Don't look too closely. I didn't clean."
"You don't clean for old friends."
They sat in the living room with coffee and snacks.
"So, here you are."
"Exactly. What, 6 blocks from where we grew up?"
"It feels strange coming back. Everybody's so ugly. I swear I never noticed."
The real Rochelle. This is what Clara wanted, but wasn't sure she'd get. "You have a new place," she said.
"Riverside Drive. How did I get so lucky? I don't know."
"You're looking very Parisian or something. The hair, maybe, or the clothes. What is it?"
"Once you start, you can't stop. It's like a disease," Rochelle said.
"You still have your willowy look, which is the envy of my life." Rochelle's husband was a developer. She called him Harry the Landman. They went to Florida and Bermuda and shopped for lingerie together on Fifth Avenue.
"So you're here, Clara, teaching art?"
"There's a community center. The children come to me, some of them kicking, some of them screaming. Others are very willing. They love to draw."
"So it's satisfying?"
"At times, yes, I enjoy it."
"So you enjoy it. So it's good. And Albert, he's a teacher, too. Everybody's a teacher. Half the world is teaching the other half."
"Albert's a real teacher, a professional."
"That's his mother in there?"
"A forceful woman, actually, even in this condition. I admire her in a number of ways. Takes no crap from anybody."
"She's dying in there?"
"Yes."
"You'll let her die in the house?"
"Yes."
"You were always open-minded that way."
"You have a lover, Clara?"
10 minutes you're in my house. The answer is no." "You want to ask me if I fool around?"
"I know what I'm supposed to say. You'd be crazy to fool around. Risk all that, Harry, the apartment, the underwear?" "But in fact..."
"Once or twice only. I need something in the afternoon, or I feel useless."
Rochelle wanted to see her work. There were several small canvases stacked against the wall in the spare room, and they stood there a while looking. The pressure Rochelle felt to say the right thing mashed her head into her torso.
"Harry wants to buy art."
"Tell him to get an advisor."
"I'll quote you that you said that."
Clara showed some pastels.
"So, Albert's a dear, sweet man, right? He likes it that you paint?"
"He thinks it relaxes me."
"So you enjoy it. You come in here and paint. I can picture you, Clara, standing here thinking, measuring with a brush. You're trying this, you're trying that."
"Once I let an elevator man rub against my thigh in Florida." They had another cup of coffee and then went upstairs to see Clara's child. She was on the floor playing with jigsaw pieces, and they stayed half an hour talking to the babysitter and watching the child make a world independent of the puzzle.
"Clara, say it. I should have a baby."
"You're the last person I would say it to."
"Thank you. We are friends to the end. Give me a hug. I'll go home happy."
They went down and stood on the stoop talking. Three men were pushing a car to get it started. A light snow was falling.
So she takes no crap, Albert's mother. Take me to her deathbed before it's too late. Maybe she could tell me something I should know.
When she was gone, Clara went into the spare room and restacked all the canvases and stood looking at the sketches she'd done. The door, the doorknob, the walls, the window frame. She sent Mrs. Ketchell home and sat with Albert's mother until it got dark. Then she went into the kitchen to do something about dinner. But first, she turned on the lamp near the bed so Albert would see his mother when he came up the steps. The pool shooter was George Manza, George the waiter, and he was playing alone at the back of the room. He was not a man who mixed with the regulars, and he was a master shooter besides. It was rare that anyone came in who could play at this level. Nick stood near a table where a gin rummy game was going, but he was watching George shoot pool. Bank the six, play beautiful position for the ace, make a massé shot that Nick could barely visualize even after he saw it. Once, nearly a year ago, George came up to Nick unexpectedly and asked him to go to the unemployment office with him. He needed to fill out some form so he could collect for the next 20 weeks, and he didn't say it outright, but Nick understood that he required help reading the forms and filling in the information. Nick also understood that an older man might not want to ask someone his own age for this kind of help. They went to the office and filled out the forms, and George didn't feel embarrassed. And ever since that day, he always had a word for Nick, some advice to give. Regards to your mother. Stay in school. Somebody says, "What's this? Fuck your buddy week?" Mike the Book stood behind the counter under the TV set, a short, square-jawed man who was always about a day late shaving. The pool room was a sideline to Mike's bookmaking operation. Sometimes he let Nick and his buddies shoot pool with the light off over the table, which meant they didn't have to pay. He caught Nick's eye and tilted his head, and when Nick walked over, he said something.
"What?" "It's called grand theft. You know this phrase?"
"What do you mean?"
Mike leaned across the counter, speaking quietly. "You think word don't get around? What's the matter with you? I thought you were smart. That chooch over there, Juju, I don't expect better. You? I'm surprised."
"Mike, the car's a throwaway. I honestly don't think the guy ever meant to drive it anymore. He left the keys in the car so somebody could take it. It's the kind of car you take it out in the woods and shoot it. So we saved him the aggravation."
"You're gonna think it's funny when you're booked at the precinct. I picture your mother, Nicky."
The dog came over and sniffed at Nick's shoes. A mutt. A stray that Mike the Book took in one day. Somebody named it Mike the Dog.
"All right. I'll see what we're gonna do."
"Get rid of it. That's what you're gonna do."
"I won't need it anymore. I'm getting a job. I can take taxis whenever I want."
"Wise guy. You're like your father."
Nick wasn't sure he wanted to hear this.
"Your father liked to put himself in a corner and then edge himself out. He was always at the edge. Not that I knew him that well. We were in the same business, but he was downtown and I was over here. And he always kept the distance anyway, your old man. Like he's somewhere else, even when he's standing next to you."
"I'll do something."
"See what you're gonna do."
"I'm this close to getting a job. My life of crime is over, Mike."
They were shooting pool at two other tables now, and when Juju started racking balls at a third table, Nick went over to shoot a game. He said,
"Mike knows."
"What? He knows?"
"I think everybody knows. How could they not know? The fucking dog knows."
"Then we're shit out of luck," Juju said.
"We put the key back in the ignition and just walk away."
"Good idea. Give me the key. I'll do it," Nick said. In the middle of the game, he went to the phone on the far wall and called Loretta. George the waiter saw him and raised his stick, and Nick tipped an imaginary hat.
"Loretta, what are you doing?"
"Trying on those shoes I bought."
"Those shoes?"
"I bought. You were with me."
"That was 3 days ago."
"So I'm still trying them on. So what?"
"You're alone?"
"My mother's here."
"You're not alone?"
My mother's here. She's there now? She lives here. It's her house. She has a right.
I just thought if you were alone.
My mother's here.
I could come over.
She's still here. She was here when you first asked, and she's still here. So meet me at the car. I parked across from Mike's.
Meet you at the car? Now you want me to meet you?
We'll drive somewhere.
What am I supposed to say? Ma, I'm going out for a bottle of milk.
Tomorrow's off. You don't have to get up for school.
I have to get up for the turkey. We have 22 people. I'm up at 6:30.
Maybe when they all leave. Tomorrow night.
Wear your shoes, he said.
He went over and watched George run the table. George had a flowery face and hollow eyes, and he talked to Nick with his nose compassed on the cue ball.
What's this about you not going to school no more?
No more, no more. Waste of time, don't you think?
Stay in school.
Stay in school. Okay, George.
You working?
I got something. I'll be doing part-time.
What?
In an ice cream freezer, packing and unpacking.
This is union?
What union? The union wants ice cream packers to do 20 minutes in the freezers, 20 minutes out, so they don't freeze their peckers off. So the company's hiring fools like me.
George slammed in the four ball with a flourish, nearly driving the stick up into the ceiling. It was interesting to see a clammed-up guy like George become a showman at the table.
You want some money in your pocket?
That's right.
And you're not thinking about the right or wrong of the situation or your own danger to your health?
That's right.
But they're going to pay you shit-ass wages. What are they paying you?
Shit-ass wages.
And they're going to keep you in the freezer for unsafe periods. Let me talk to a guy I know. Maybe I can get you something better. You work like a beast of burden, but at least you don't wear no mittens.
Vito Batts had taken Nick's place at the other table. Nick went over and watched, smoking, pointing out errors in their game.
Everybody knows, he said. We just have to leave it, Vito said. We don't go near it anymore. I'll take my uncle's plates off late tonight. They'll see a car with no plates, they'll tow it away. Goodbye, good riddance.
You'll never get laid, Vito. Both you guys. That car is your only hope.
I'd rather die a saint in my coffin than go to jail with 10,000 tizones. Give me the keys. I told Juju, give me the keys. I'd take care of everything.
Give him my Uncle Tommy's plates. Maybe I'll give you the keys.
Take the fucking plates. I'm taking the keys.
You're taking Ugats. That's what you're taking.
Hard on. Give me the keys.
Ugats, all right?
See that stick? The stick you're holding? The stick you're holding?
All's I'm saying, Nicky.
Cunt lap, give me the keys.
He was talking to Vito, even though he knew Juju had the keys. He didn't want to put Juju in a position where he would lose pride or standing. But Vito, with those thick glasses and big lips, fish lips, he had those wet lips he was always licking.
I don't get the keys. You know what happens to that stick? The stick you're holding? I give you one guess where it goes.
George the waiter paid and left, and soon the card players came in, blinking in the smoke, the high-stakes poker players. They played till 4 or 5 in the morning, chips massed in the pot, and a guy named Walls sitting by the door. Walls carried a .38, this was the story, somewhere on his hip. 4 of the players were here, and they stood at the counter talking to Mike, and after a while 2 more players arrived, and the lights over the pool tables began to go off, and the pool shooters drifted out. Somebody croons in a clear tenor.
Bluer than velvet was the night.
Walls was sitting by the door, different from the others. A narrow face and long jaw, hair cut short. And Nick watched him from the counter. And Walls caught the look and raised his eyebrows slightly. In other words, there's something you want to say to me? Nick smiled and shrugged, taking his change.
Be good, Mike said.
Vito borrowed a small folding knife off Mike's keychain, and the 3 thieves went down to effectuate removal of the plates. Mike the dog went with them. Nick watched them work and pointed out flaws in their method. He pissed against the hospital wall, drawing the dog's attention, and then went back to the car, where they were still disengaging the plates, and he commented freely. Vito said,
"Hey, don't be such a skook, you meant, all right?"
"Give me the keys," Nick said. "We're not finished." "You'll never be finished, because you're a scumbag in the shape of a human. You're a scumbag that's going to marry a douchebag when you're 21, Vito. God bless you, I'm serious, you and your lovely children."
When they got the plates off, Juju handed the keys to Nicky. It was his car now, a green heap, naked of documentation. Gas tank close to empty. Nick said he'd take the dog back up to Mike's, and the two guys went their separate ways, and Nick crossed the street with the dog alongside. He started up the stairs talking to the dog, and when he was 3/4 of the way up, the tall door creaked open, and the man named Walls stood there with his hand in his jacket. Nick smiled at him.
"Walk in the dog," he said.
Walls stepped back so the dog could get in. Then he stood in the opening again.
"I thought that was a thing you do with a yo-yo."
"That's right," Nick said, "walking the dog. But I think my yo-yo days are over."
Walls showed a slight smile. Nick approached and looked through the opening, hoping that Mike might see him and invite him in to watch the game a while. Walls shook his head, still smiling, and Nick nodded once and went back down the stairs. He got in the car, started it up, and drove it to the original parking spot, 2 blocks away. Then they got out, walked around the car, inspecting it for this and that, and went back to the stoop in front of his building, where he sat haunched on the iron rail, smoking one last cigarette before he went upstairs.
Chapter 3.
The knife grinder came and went. Matty was supposed to listen for the knife grinder's bell, and then go downstairs with the knives that she'd set out on the kitchen table. Knives to be sharpened and money to pay, all set out. On her way home, she saw the fresh air inspectors standing on the corner. Elderly men, mostly. They were out even in cold weather, provided the sun was shining. And they stood there breathing steam, changing their position inchingly with the arc of the sun. And when she went upstairs, the knives were on the table, dull-edged, and there was the money in bills and coins, 35 cents a blade, untouched and unspent. And Matt was at his board in the parlor, waiting for Mr. Bronzini. Rosemary took off her hat and coat and said nothing. She went into the bedroom, where the frame was set between the sawhorses, and she turned on the radio and began to do her beadwork. What she knew about the knife grinder was that he came from the same region as Jimmy's people, near a town called Campo Basso, in the mountains, where boys were raised to sharpen knives. It took 2 hours to bead a sweater. She listened to the radio, but not really, you know, letting the voice drift in and out. She guided the needle through the fabric and thought of Jimmy's stories. She used to fight to keep him out of her thoughts, but it wasn't possible, was it? He replaced the radio in her mind. She said, "What happened to the knives?" There was a long pause in the next room. He said,
"He never came. I never heard the bell."
She said, "He always comes on Tuesday. He never misses a Tuesday. Since we've been here, except if it's Christmas Day, he will be here on a Tuesday." She waited for a response. She could sense the boy's surrender and resentment, the small crouched shape squeezed in utter stillness.
"Am I wrong, or is this a Tuesday?"
she said in a final little dig. She saw the pigeons erupt from the roof across the street, bursting like fireworks, 50 or 60 birds, and then the long pole swaying above the ledge, so long and reedy it bent of its own dimensions. Mr. Bronzini knocked on the door, and Matty let him in. The Italian women in the building, which almost all of them were, called her Rose. They thought this was her name, or one of them did, and the others picked it up. And she never corrected them because she just didn't. Never mind hello. They started right in talking about a move, a maneuver from a couple of days before. Mr. Bronzini sometimes forgot to take off his coat before he sat down at the board.
Jimmy used to say, carte blanche.
The boy who kept the pigeon stood invisible behind the ledge, waving the pole to guide the birds in their flight. They lapsed into a long, pondering silence at the board, then started talking at once, yakety-yak together. She strung the beads onto the fabric. She didn't want to be a sob story where people feel sorry for you, and you go through life dragging a burden the size of a house. Jimmy used to say, "Here's some money. You have carte blanche how you spend it. I don't even want to know," he'd say. She heard a woman in the hall yelling down to her kid, her head out the door yelling to the kid who's galloping down the steps. "I'm making gravy," the woman yelled. How is it we did so much laughing? How is it people came over with their empty pockets and bad backs and not-so-good marriages, and 20 minutes later we're all laughing? They started a legend that he memorized every bet, but he didn't. They still tell stories about his memory, how he moved through the loft buildings taking bets from cutters, sweepers, and salesmen, and recording every figure mentally. But he didn't. He had pieces of paper all over his clothes with bets scribbled down. She heard the women talk about making gravy, speaking to a husband or child, and Rosemary understood the significance of this. It meant, "Don't you dare come home late." It meant, "This is serious, so pay attention." It was a special summons, a call to family duty. The pleasure, yes, of familiar food, the whole history of food, the history of eating, the garlicky smack and tang. But there was also a duty, a requirement. The family requires the presence of every member tonight, because the family was an art to these people, and the dinner table was the place it found expression. They said, "I'm making gravy." They said, "Who's better than me?" It did not happen violent. This was a thing she would never believe, that they took him away in a car. The man went out for cigarettes and just kept walking. She didn't want her children to see her dragging, slumping, thinking too much, brooding, angry, empty. Conceal, conceal. But it was hard. They told her to change her hair, the women in the building. They told her she had a Mother Hubbard hairdo. No, she wasn't empty, just tense much of the time. Hearing a voice inside that she'd never heard before. Her own voice, only edgy and angry and one track. She listened to Mr. Bronzini in the living room. He spoke about the truth of a position. The radio was doing a serial drama called Bright Horizons, or Bright Tomorrows, or Brighter Days. And every position has a truth, he told Mattie. A deep truth is what you want, not a shallow truth. You want a position worth defending to the death. This food, this family meal, this meat sauce simmering in a big pot with sausage and spare ribs and onions and garlic, this was their loyalty and bond and well-being. And the aroma was in the halls for Rosemary to smell when she climbed the flights. Rolled beef, meatballs, basil, and the savor had an irony that was painful. He used to come home and get undressed, Jimmy, and pieces of paper would fall out of his clothes, scraps of paper, bets in code, his own scrawled cipher of people's names, horses' names, teams, and odds, and sums of money. They said, "See what you're going to do." How is it she could laugh all night at his stories about a day in the garment district? Or a day when he went to Toot Shore's famous restaurant, out of the district. The famous Toot Shore, out of his jurisdiction completely. But Toot Shore met him and liked him and wanted to give him some action. And he was a heavy bettor, very. And Jimmy made occasional trips to West 51st Street to take limited bets from Toot Shore. A big lumbering man with a face like a traffic accident. And he told her stories about the well-heeled bums around the big bar, drinking until 4 in the morning. "I'm making gravy," they said. The wife of Mr. Imperato, the lawyer she worked for in her regular job, called a couple of times a week and said, "Tell him I'm making gravy." She did her beadwork off the books.
The pigeons climbed and wheeled, and the long pole swayed above the ledge.
Some women have one man in their life, and he was the one, that bastard, in hers.
Mr. Imperator liked to joke about our famous forefathers, Abraham Linguine and George Washing Machine. In warmer weather, Maddie sat at the board on his BVDs. How little he looked, so thin and pale. But his eyes were fixed on the pieces so hard and hot, she could easily think there was someone else in there, sent to possess the boy. The trick was, the thing was, he was not the center of the family when he was here. She was the center, the still center, the strength. Now that he was gone, she could no longer make herself feel still or especially central. Jimmy was central now. That was the trick, the strange thing. Jimmy was the heartbeat, the missing heartbeat. It was a promise that was also a call to duty. Tell him I'm making gravy. They said, see what you're going to do. This was a threat to a son or daughter who was not behaving. Straighten out, change your attitude, see what you're going to do. They said, who's better than me? This was a statement of the importance of small pleasures. A meal, a coat with a fake fur collar, a chair in front of a fan on a hot day. It did not happen violent. It was the small thing of a weak man walking out the door. It was not big. It was not men with guns who tie paving stones to someone's ankles and put a bullet in his head. It was small and weak. If you could feel the soul of an experience, then you earned the right to say, who's better than me? Jimmy knew some dialect. Abruzzese. He used to take the knives down and talk to the knife grinder. And he found it satisfying to use the dialect. They talked while the man sharpened the knives, and it was something Jimmy did not do with men he saw more often who came from the same region, or their people did. He talked to the knife grinder, because he saw him only rarely, and this was an arrangement he preferred. They called her Rose. They had assurance and force, most of them. They had nerve and personality and loud voices. Not all, but most. She did her beadwork, her piecework, working off the books, just like Jimmy. He slept continuous. Never got up in the night. Drank coffee and slept right through. Didn't seem to feel the cold. Walked barefoot on the cold floors. Slept in his shorts on those winter nights when she'd finally hear the heat whistling in the pipes, her signal to get up for mass. Somebody put serious money on a horse called Terra Firma, and he began to worry when it finished first. She listened to Maddie analyze the position. They stopped the game occasionally and talked out the moves. He was not a braggadocio. He told sly, quiet stories late at night. Conceal, conceal. But it was hard. The baseball man Charlie Dressen was a horse player. Jimmy took his bets. He took bets from Toot Shore. He left $700 in a coat that she took to the dry cleaner. The coat was his private bank, only he never told her, and she took it to the dry cleaner, and went back when she found out about the money, and they said, what money, lady? There was an inside pocket she didn't know was there. What money, lady? She applied the beads with a wood-handled needle, following the design printed on the fabric. But how is it we did so much laughing? How is it we went dancing the night of the $700, and we laughed and drank? He was not a harum-scarum guy who took crazy chances, but the long shot came in, and he began to feel the pressure to pay off. Who's better than me? They said. This was a statement she couldn't make, partly out of personality, but also because she could not feel the ordinary contentment of things the way she used to. She could not feel favored or charmed. He'd replaced her life with his leaving. The voice running through her head was not the voice she used to hear before he left. But how is it we ate a German meal on 86th Street and went dancing at the Corso down the block, $700 poorer? There was less of her now, and more of other people. She was becoming other people. Maybe that's why they called her Rose. Nick was walking the halls at school. This close to Christmas, the Catholic school kids were already off. Maddie was off. The shopping area was decorated with lights and wreaths. The merchants were putting out trees at 5 in the morning, which you could smell from a distance. And there were eels on sale for Christmas Eve, and spruce and balsam fir stacked against the walls, from upstate, and kids unloading crates of grapes from California for customers who made their own wine. Nick wandered the halls smoking, and Remo came out of a classroom wearing tight-pegged pants and the Eisenhower jacket he never took off. "What are you doing here?"
"Taking a walk," Nick said.
"You take walks indoors?
You been out? Fucking freezing.
What are you doing here?"
"Hey, I go to school here."
"What are you doing here?"
"Taking a walk," Nick said.
"I got a pass to see the doctor."
"The nurse. That's who you want to see."
"Save me a drag," Remo said.
"Where's home economics?"
"I don't know. The end of that hall, maybe."
"I hear you're working."
"Ice cream plant.
Pays decent?"
"Forget about it."
"It's steady, then?"
"You have to shape up like the docs," Nick said, and he felt like a man saying this.
"A guy says, you, 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 you. Everybody else goes home."
Remo seemed impressed.
"You get to eat the merchandise?"
"Actually, you want to know the truth?"
"What?"
"We steal it and sell it, but we have to work fast." Remo didn't know whether to believe this. He reached for the butt end of Nick's cigarette, and Nick gave it to him, and he took 2 hungry drags and then dropped it, stomped it, exhaled, and went into the doctor's office. After the bell rang and the classrooms emptied out, Nick spotted Loretta and Gloria, and they walked out onto Fordham Road together.
"Allie's father hit a number,"
Gloria said.
"I know, I heard. He had $5 on it, if you can believe that."
"It's true. I know it for a fact," Nick said. An older guy named Jasper, a noted cunt man, sat in a Ford convertible with the top down yet in this weather, motor running, listening to the radio. The two girls were quiet walking by, quiet together by mutual consent, exchanging unspoken thoughts about Jasper.
"Who puts $5?
Loretta said.
"They put 50 cents. They put a dollar if they're feeling very, very lucky."
"He had a dream," Nick said.
"He had a dream. What kind of dream?"
"What kind of dream? He dreamed the number. What else would he dream?"
"For $5, she said. "It must have been very convincing."
"It was in Technicolor," Gloria said.
"If I dream a number, I think I'm going to die on that date," Loretta said. "This man gives $5 to a gangster."
"Gangster? What kind of gangster?"
"He gave the money to Annette Esposito."
"Who's that?"
"She's a Catholic school girl. She goes to my brother's school," Nick said. "She runs numbers for her father. Every day she makes the rounds."
"In her school uniform?" Gloria said.
"The customers like a runner they can trust."
They walked past White Castle, where kids were eating sawdust hamburgers. And then Gloria crossed the street and went into her building.
"Where's your radio?"
"You used to carry your radio all the time," Loretta said.
"I had a radio in my car. That's the only radio I needed."
"It's for the best," she said.
"You think it's for the best?"
"I'm relieved," she said. "That car, my God! What wasn't wrong with it? Not to mention it was stolen property."
"We didn't have nice times in that car?"
"The drive-in was nice. Not the parking on dark streets like criminals."
"That's what we were," he said.
She laughed. She had 2 teeth that didn't exactly match on either side of the incisors, and he thought it gave her a sexy smile. They turned east, and he saw a garbage truck and saw Juju's father
who was a garbage man, jumped down off the truck and stride across the sidewalk, and flip the lid off a can and muscle the can over to the truck and then upend it into the grinder.
"See that guy? That's Juju's father,"
he said with an edge of pride in his voice. He admired the graceful action, the long, continuous body motion from the cellar entrance to the truck, the way the man wrestled the can across the sidewalk, all forearm action, and the freedom to make noise, skidding the can and running the grinder, and then the hoist and dump, a shoulder motion mainly, and the original pitch of the lid, a gesture of half-contempt but also graceful, which he earned by the nature of the work he did. And flinging the can back toward the wrought-iron fence that guarded the basement steps, also a privilege of the job, Nikki thought. They reached her building and went inside. Loretta stood in the hallway and turned to be kissed, and he kissed her, moving her up against the mailboxes with her books between their bodies sliding back and forth.
"Who's home?" he said. "They're all home."
He pressed her into the mailboxes and could hear the friction of her skirt when she moved against the slits in the metal where you could see if you had mail.
"You still think it's for the best I don't have my car?"
"It's broad daylight, car or no car.
We could park in the parking lot at Orchard Beach. Just the seagulls and us." She kissed him.
"So steal another car,"
she said slurringly. He opened his eyes while he was kissing her, and she was looking at him with wide brown eyes that seemed to be thinking seven things at once. She knew he'd had sex with other girls, hand jobs, blow jobs, whatever else, putting it in, taking it out, putting it in, keeping it in, bareback, rubber, whatnot. And she knew who the girls were, from Washington Avenue, from Valentine Avenue, one from Kingsbridge Road, because somebody told somebody who made sure it got back to her. And he knew that she knew, from Gloria passing a remark to Juju, like one of the radio serials his mother listened to, doing her beadwork.
"You'll meet me tomorrow?" she said. "I work tomorrow." "They're all home. What can I say?"
"I have to work. What can I say?"
"When's the last time you washed your hair?" she said.
He walked a while and ended up going into the zoo on an impulse, entering by the big bronze gate. And he went up past the sea lions in a cold, stiff wind with the place just about empty of visible humans. He missed his shit-heap Chevy. No plates, no insurance, no license to drive it, transmission shot to hell. The door on the passenger side opening up unannounced every time he made a left turn. Driving only at night in a skulking and shadowy manner, mostly alone, smoking, the radio frequently fading out. He was angry about something. But it was something else, not the car or the girlfriend. The thing that ran through his mind even in his sleep. He walked for half an hour, and then stood by the wildfowl pond. When he was in grade school, he'd come to the zoo with a kid named Martin Mannion, and Martin Mannion had climbed a fence. It was a day like this, wintry and empty, and Martin Mannion climbed into the buffalo enclosure and stood there waving his jacket at the buffalo, the bison. And the huge, nappy animal from off a five-cent piece just looked at him indifferent. And Martin Mannion got so mad he took out his dick and peed. It was beginning to get dark now. He stood at the edge of the pond and lit another cigarette, turning his back to the wind.
"Call me Alan," he says. "Call me Alan." I says, "What's Alan?" He says to me, "That's my name." "That's my name." I look at him. I says to him, "How could that be your name? You already got a name."
"What happened to Alphonse?"
I says, "What happened to Alphonse? You were Alphonse for 16 years. Your grandfather was Alphonse."
"The both of them."
"Two grandfathers, Alphonse. What happened?" He says, "I'm not them."
"Miserable little cross-eyed."
"I'm not them," he says.
"He's king shit, that's who he is."
"Call me Alan," he says.
"I'm not them."
I could break his back.
"I'm not them."
I says, "Who are you?"
"He's king shit, that's who he is."
I says, who are you, Stunat, if you're not them?
Giulio Belisario, Juju, had never seen a dead body, including at a wake, and he was interested in the experience.
Who's going to die? Nicky said, just so you can satisfy your curiosity.
I missed my grandmother when I had the measles.
I'm looking around. I don't see any volunteers. You hear about Allie's father?
What?
You don't know this?
What? He died?
He hit a number.
I was gonna say. He's buying a Buick. One day he's a fishmonger. The next day... I was gonna say. I just saw him yesterday in the market. How could he be dead?
How long does it take? Nicky said.
I'm only saying.
One day he's selling scungili, the next day, hey, kiss my ass.
Who's better than him? Juju said.
I'm driving a big-ass Buick. Stand clear, you peasants.
They were in the grocery that occupied a storefront in Nicky's building at 611. The grocer's wife, Donato's wife, the only name they knew her by, tolerated their presence because she liked Nicky's mother. Outside, five older guys were gathered, and one of them, Scarfo, was doing broad jumps at the instigation of the other four. Scarfo wanted to take the sanitation test, and they'd convinced him he needed to broad jump 6 feet from a standing start, and he was out there in his good coat and creased pants, jumping cracks on the sidewalk to see if he could do it. The two young men stood inside the store smoking and watching.
I saw your father, Nicky said.
He's picking up in the neighborhood, temporary.
He ever find anything in the garbage?
What could he find? That he brings home? Forget about it.
He could find something valuable.
My mother would have a conniption fit. Forget about it. Donato's wife gave them each a piece of sliced salami, and they watched Scarfo work on his jump. Matty bit his shirt cuff. A slink of a kid with lively eyes. And he looked across the board at Mr. Bronzini, who was smiling twistedly.
You killed me, Albert said.
I saw everything.
You came, you saw, and so on, and you killed me.
He knew that Matty loved hearing this. He loved winning at chess, and he loved hearing the loser declare himself dead. Because that's what he was, kaput. And it was Matty who'd crushed him. The boy's mother stood in the doorway watching.
How many moves did it take?
No, don't tell me, Albert said. I want to preserve some self-respect. Matty and his mother were delighted.
He's beginning to think in systems, Albert said to her. I think this is a sign that good things will begin happening again.
The adults had a cup of tea, and Matt stayed at the board, a small floating godhead above the pawns and rooks. The boy had taken some more losses lately, including a rout at the Manhattan Chess Club, and this was deeply disappointing all around because Father Paulus had appeared. Came, saw, said little, and left. After a while, Albert went over to Arthur Avenue, where he saw the chestnut man pushing his oven on wheels, a cartoon contraption, smoke coming out of the bent metal chimney. There was a peach basket appended to one end of the oven to hold the unroasted chestnuts and sweet potatoes. He bought some chestnuts, which he more or less juggled in a piece of wrapping paper because they were damn hot, and he carried them down the side street into the barber shop. George the barber led him into the back room, where they sat at a small table eating the chestnuts and washing them down with wincing sips of old Mr. Boston, a rye whiskey unknown to the Cabots and the Lodges. Albert knew that George had a wife and a little house somewhere, and a married daughter somewhere else. But the man was otherwise unimaginable outside his barbership. Stout, bald, unblessed with excess personality, he belonged completely to the massive porcelain chairs, two of them, to the hot towel steamer, the stamped tin ceiling, the marble shelf beneath the mirror, the tinted glass cabinets, the bone-handled razor and leather strop, the horn combs, the scissor and clippers, the cup, the brush, the shaving soap,
the fragrance of witch hazels and brilliantines and talcums. George the barber knew who he was.
Biagio hit a number, he said.
Who, Biagio?
He hit a number, 600 to 1.
From the fish market, Biagio?
He hit a number, George said.
When the chestnuts were gone, he refilled their glasses, and they sat there sipping quietly, thinking about someone hitting a number.
And how is the woman? He said to Albert.
The woman?
Yes, how is the marriage? He said.
The radio was tuned to the Italian station, and an announcer was signing off with repeated cries of "Baci a tutti," which was fine with Albert, absolutely, the way he felt in the bracing wake of the whiskey.
This is a subject so immense.
Of course. What else?
Big, 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 big.
Too much, too much, the barber said. I can only say one thing.
There's only one thing to say.
Every marriage, not just mine or yours.
Exactly.
How can I put it, George? Un po' complicato.
Of course. What else can we say?
What else is new?
What else is new? The barber said.
Albert licked at a dusting of chestnut on his fingers. A woman and child came in, and George moved into the front of the shop, and Albert drained his glass and followed, because he didn't want to presume on the man's hospitality. He spoke to the woman while George arranged the boy's special seat. Then he put on his hat and coat and left. He stopped in Mussolini Park and spent a few minutes talking with the old men. The fake priest went past, Benedetti, wearing a lumberjacket and a black beretta and carrying a breviary. He moved his lips as if in prayer, but held the book unopened to his chest. Albert had to sit. He realized he was slightly woozy. Umbriaggio, the mayor of New York or of Chicago. And he sat on a bench and waited for the feeling to pass. The other men drifted off. The sun was edging behind the extended mass of the hospital for the incurable, and it was colder now, with flurries in the air. And the men drifted off to a storefront social club, or a candy store, or home. A tow truck went by at a crazy speed, rushing to get to the wreck before the competition. Albert sat on the bench and waited for his head to clear. The important thing is to sit and wait, to be patient. The other important thing is not to vomit. You see a man every so often standing over a curbstone vomiting. He did not want to think of himself as that kind of man. He sat there, feeling all right, feeling slightly less dizzy now and generally all right. Baci a tutti, he thought. To everyone on the street, yes, kisses. And the faces went muddling through his mind. The bread makers, grandmothers, street sweepers, to the priests who are and those who aren't. The kids called it heave. I think I'm going to heave, Johnny. A car pulled up and he heard the hoarse voice of the butcher calling across to him.
Albert, che succede?
Hello, Joe. Merry Christmas.
It's snowing. Go home.
I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm fine.
You want a ride?
Go, 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 go. Merry Christmas. I'm fine. Goodbye. He heard the train pull into the station about a block away. He heard it shriek around the bend and rumble into the station, and he sat in the wind's high howl, waiting for his head to clear completely.
This ends Disc 23.